Committee Legislative Assistant will note the roll. Representative Simon moves approval of the minutes for February 7th, 2005. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. We have three bills on the agenda, members. The first is House File 515. I will move House File 515 be recommended to pass and sent where, Representative Holbrook?
General Register.
To the General Register. All right. Representative Holbrook.
Thank you very much, Chair Johnson and committee. The bill that's before us today is House File 515 would reduce the size of the legislature. There's many people that would support that for various reasons, but the reasoning behind this bill is very logical. What it would do is it would identify the number of Senate districts as being a factor of the number of congressional districts. Why would we want to do this? Well, besides the fact that it would make a slightly smaller legislature, as far as for organizational purposes, it would make things a lot easier, both for party organizations, things like choosing regents, and for our people that work in elections that set up the balloting process, the notifications, sample ballots, etc. All House or all Senate districts would be included within one congressional district. Given that we have eight congressional districts at this time, it would mean that we would reduce the number of districts in the next reapportionment cycle to 64. And then, of course, we would have the double the amount of House districts for 128 House districts. How would that leave us as a state relative to other legislatures? Well, currently we have the largest Senate in the country, and from as far as numbers of senators. And then the next question people always like to ask, well, what does that mean to the size of the constituency? Well, currently we have the 30th largest constituency for Senate members. That would go, or 31st would go to 30, and from the House would go from 26 to 25. So it really wouldn't change our ranking much in the proportion of the number of constituents our districts would have. What would it have meant if this had occurred prior to the last redistricting? Each House district would have had 1,720 more members within their House districts. Now, in the bill, you can see we dictate that the number of Senate districts would be no fewer than 60 and no more than 64. Those numbers would accommodate congressional districts of anywhere from 5 to 10. And so, in other words, if we dropped to 7 or went to 9, we'd have 63 Senate districts. And so hopefully that range would serve us well for a long time. In the number of congressional seats, hopefully we don't see that large of a shift in population, at least to the negative. Maybe we'd like it to the positive. In the past, this is the fourth session that we have carried this bill. I think in the first two sessions that I was a legislator, it was too close to redistricting, and people weren't sure how it was would affect them. Now that we're far enough out away from redistricting, I'm hopeful that people will evaluate on the merits of the policy and the continuity as opposed to what does it mean for me personally. In 1999, when the bill was put forward, it would have had a reduction in the tails number because we were close enough that the reduction in the legislature would have showed up in the out-biennium. The fiscal note at that time showed an approximate savings of $1.9 million a year. And I would assume that there would be a little larger savings than that, but again, we wouldn't book it anywhere in our budget documents at this time because it wouldn't take effect into out-bienniums that we don't consider for budgeting purposes at this time. I have with me today a special guest and testifier. This is former Representative Walter Klaus. He served in the House of Representatives from 1957 to 1973. He has taken on redistricting as a passion. He has worked on a number of them. He, during the redistricting process that occurred around 2000, he was running around here with maps and lists just like everybody else. And so Representative Klaus has pushed this as a policy issue for years and is here to say a few words, and we'd be happy to stand for any questions.
All right. Mr. Klaus, welcome to the Civil Law and Elections Committee. If you would introduce yourself for the record, and then please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I'm Walter Klaus. I'm a citizen, former legislator. It was, and I've come to speak in favor of this bill. I have liked this idea for a long time. I remember proposing it to a committee corresponding to yours 32 years ago. And at that time, the committee hadn't thought of this concept. The primary idea of this bill is that senatorial districts do not cross congressional district lines to make, as Representative Holberg has pointed out, to make organization for political parties and for legislative candidates, to make it somewhat simpler and more efficient. We, in this committee, I presented the idea to the committee. The chair, or the author of the bill we were considering, he did like that a while, and then he withdrew his bill. The next week he was back with different numbers. It was to reduce the size of the legislature. He had different numbers, he said, to comply with the idea Mr. Klaus presented last week. We passed it out of the committee unanimously, but in those days the leadership wasn't too interested in something like this. But today we are here, and we think that you folks would find this to be a very practical bill. In addition to the things that Representative Holberg has pointed out, this bill would help a little bit when you come, as I understand you'll be doing this month, to the election of regents of the university. You don't have to wonder, well, are we going to give in our caucus this representative who has only two precincts in our congressional district, are we going to give him a full vote in choosing our recommendation for regents? This would simplify that too. Only people with full committees would be sitting on your caucus for regent nominees. I would be glad to answer any questions you might want to direct to me.
And if I might, for clarification purposes, this was featured in the session weekly last week. We'll put that as mug in the magazine, so I said he could have an extra copy to take home for his baby book. But the other thing that I might make note of is in the article it states that this would have to go before the voters in 06. That is not correct. This is a change that could be made by the legislature. And so I just wanted to keep it, if you read this article and were under the impression that it needed to go on the ballot, it does not. Just in closing, currently we have three House districts that are split by three congressional districts. Representative Broad is one of those, and Connie Bernardi and Karen Klinsing. And we have 27 House districts that are split into two congressional districts. And I think I hold the record during the last redistricting process. My little House district was split into four congressional districts. And not only is it hard for organizational purposes, but it's really difficult for the constituency to sort out, well, I'm in Holberg's district, but I'm in three or two or one, and let alone the city of Lake, they'll try to keep up with four different congressional people. And certainly that might happen again with the city boundaries, but it just provides a nice continuity to the map. In the past, the current Republican Party platform supports this idea, and the DFL Party has language on their website that they would like to see the congressional redistricting follow Senate district lines as much as possible. So both parties have experienced the same level of frustration in trying to work with these House and Senate districts that are all bisected by congressional district lines.
Thank you. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I just have a quick question, and the premise of it is, one thing that we do right now, it seems to me, that I like, is in the state redistricting process, I'm told that the guidelines require that those drawing the lines, to the extent possible, keep cities in the same Senate district. And I have the situation, for example, where the city of Hopkins is mostly in one congressional district, but a sliver of it is in another. And it just sort of occurs to me that most people more readily identify themselves as residents of a city than as our district or a congressional district. I mean, I think most people can't even name what congressional district they're in or legislative district. Should I be or should others be worried that this would affect that? In other words, if, you know, under the current scheme, if we were to divide Senate districts so that they were all within a congressional district, that would mean that I would lose a portion of Hopkins and the city of Hopkins would be divided. And I'm, I guess, more concerned about that than dividing along legislative districts, that everyone in a city can say, hey, yeah, we all share the same congressman or we all share the same state House member or state Senate member. Is that unfounded, or how do you respond to that?
Chair Johnson and Representative Simon, I think that I can't give you a definitive answer. What I can tell you is that the standard to try and keep cities together could remain a standard in setting up House and Senate district lines. The requirements for the distribution of individuals into congressional districts is much more strict. In fact, I think it's down to the individual person that they have to be divided based on the census numbers, where House and Senate districts, the deviation, if you will, off of the exact number can be set by the legislature. And different plans, from my recollection, during the last redistricting had deviations of anywhere from 1 to 3%. So that flexibility that's allowed in the House and Senate redistricting process would be more easily adapted to keeping cities together. And I'm not sure how the relationship of that to the congressional districts would actually shake out. But the flexibility is there within the Senate. State Senate line.
Just one quick follow-up. Who goes first in redistricting? I guess I don't remember, or I don't think I ever knew. Do the congressional districts get carved up first, or do the state Senate districts get carved up? I don't know the answer.
I think it can be done either way. There's no law that dictates that, but again, the fact that the congressional standard for deviation is so tight or virtually doesn't exist, in most instances, you would assume that they would draw those first and then subdivide the Senate and House districts within those 8 congressional districts.
Thank you.
Senator Ellison. Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I wonder if you could share with us, is what's driving this? Is it the desire to reduce the size of the legislature, or is it to have the state senatorial lines conform to the congressional districts? Which is pushing with?
Representative Fulber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and certainly Mr. Klaus can comment as well. From my personal perspective, having a House district bisected by 4 congressional lines, at the time I had the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 6th. And so to attend congressional meetings, there was one in Manterville. There was one, you know what, I can't even tell you where, because it was some little town in southwestern Minnesota, and I actually never went to a 1st district meeting. The 3rd district was out in the western suburbs, and that was when the 6th district was held by Luther and wrapped around all the way up to Stillwater up into Anoka County. And so it was impossible to keep track and go to all of the endorsing conventions and et cetera that you would like to participate in as a state legislator. I would be less than forthright if I said that a reduction in the size of the legislature didn't appeal to me. It does. I think that when you see where we are in these rankings nationally and what it would mean for a change in population, it's not a big change. Certainly, my particular district, before they even got redistricting done, had gained more than 2,000 residents, and prior to redistricting, had the second highest population of any House district in the state due to the growth, and it was very manageable for me to address the needs of my constituents with those numbers. So the reduction is not, in my mind, a negative, but not the number one driving factor for the bill.
Senator Ellison.
Mr. Chair, now, Representative Holberg, you live in a suburban district, and, you know, you can get around there, you know, pretty easily, and I live in an urban district. I can literally walk from one end of my district to the other. There's a whole lot of people packed in there, but it's not that big. What about people who are representing rural districts? I mean, is this going to create a real problem for them in terms of getting around the district, campaigning, stuff like that? I guess for myself, probably doesn't matter that much. It's a few extra blocks in the neighborhood. For you, maybe it's not a big deal either. But what about some of our colleagues who really got quite a bit of distance.
Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair and Representative Ellison, I think that is a factor to consider, but quite frankly, the change in population in the rural areas is changing as well, with migration. We can't predict in a 10-year cycle what demographics of a particular area are. Luckily, we're seeing some increased population. Some of the economic development is yielding some results. May it end up with larger, some districts larger in the rural area? Yeah, it likely will, but there are a lot of other factors that are going to contribute to the size of those districts as well beyond this type of legislation.
Representative Westrum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbert, just a question, and maybe I apologize if I missed it right at the beginning of your explanation, but what's the magic with 128, and how does this exactly work out that it'll never have Congress or boundaries going over Congress, congressional districts?
Mr. Chair and Representative Westrum, the bill dictates a range of between 60 to 64 Senate districts that would be a factor of the number of congressional districts. So at the number, so if we stay with 8 congressional districts, there'd be 64 Senate districts, 8 in each of the congressional districts. If we should go to 7 or 9, the number of senators would go to 63. You know, if it's 7 districts, there'd be 9 Senate districts in each congressional district.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, if we went down to 7 or up to 9, the legislature would actually shrink the House, the Senate by 1 and the House by 2 under that scenario.
Well, from where we are now, of course, to in the next redistricting, if we retain 8 congressional seats, we go down 3 Senate districts from 67 to 64. Should we go to 7 or 9, that difference would be 4.
Okay, so the legislature theoretically could fluctuate every 10 years, a couple more, either way.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just some comments. As most of you know, my dad served in this House. He also served in the Senate. And just an example, along with Representative Ellingson's questioning, when he was at last in the Senate, his district included half the city of Anoka down to the Mississippi River, all of Isanti County, all of Chisago County, and all of Pine County. So that put him within 30 miles of Duluth. Now, as Representative Holberg has stated, the difficulty she had being pulled 4 different congressional districts, I think it's a bigger issue being pulled between the needs and wants of people in the city of Anoka versus the people in northern Pine County, and everything in between. I think that if we look at, as us, not as elected officials, but us as citizens, the opportunity to interact at any time with our state senator, and more importantly, our state house members, versus how often do we have the opportunity to do the same type of interaction with either our U.S. congressman or most especially a U.S. senator. We're moving people further away from government, in my mind, in doing something like this. I don't see a great economic gain here to the state, maybe $75,000 to $100,000 a year, but I do fear about pulling ourselves as elected people further away, and I doubt that many, if any, of us will be here in 2013, but you know, it's kind of nice to be able to pick up the phone and know your legislator, and when you talk about a particular issue in your city or whatever, or if you are a city official, they know darn good and well what you're talking about. So that's my comments. Thank you, sir.
Well, Mr. Chair, that point about changing size of the legislative districts, I mean, a number of factors will affect that, but just for a fun fact, I remember Speaker Steve Swigum door knocking on my door when I was in high school. So he had part of Lakeville in the 70s.
Any other discussion or questions? Anyone from the audience want to testify on this bill? Representative Holbrook, did you have anything else to add?
Well, I would just add that the comment
Mr. Klaus.
Here, Mr. Chairman, is on which comes first, the legislative or the congressional redistricting. That's a matter that the people who are working on it, that's sort of up to them. One point in this proposal would be, though, that it would, mind and experience, it would make congressional redistricting easier. I would think the legislative would be done first and complying with this. And then after the legislative districts were determined, you just pick out your number of Senate districts, which is 8. You pick up 8 Senate districts and put them in the congressional district. And I would expect that it would be they'd be put together in the way that would most nearly conform to whatever the plan was at that time. But that's entirely up to ultimately to the legislature, because the legislature is the only body that really has the authority to determine the districts.
All right.
I might make one little comment. The thought came to mind. You know, in this confusion as they are, one year the people in one municipality in our district had the wrong ballots for their congressmen. It was an error, but it illustrates the confusion that we have. And this bill tries to, one of the purposes is to try to eliminate the confusion that comes into the minds of the voters as they go to the polls on the election day. Otherwise, the general public doesn't think much about this.
Thank you, Mr. Powell. Seeing no further discussion, the chair renews his motion that House File 515 be recommended to pass and sent to the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next bill is House File 473, Representative Olson. The chairman will also move House File 473 be recommended to pass and sent where, Representative Olson?
Mr. Chair, I believe this goes to the General Register.
Okay.
I haven't
be sent
heard
to
anything
the General
otherwise.
Register. And Representative Olson, is this your author's amendment?
That's correct.
Okay. I will move that as well. It is Amendment S0473A1, and there is a error on here on the first line one. It says SF is Senate file. It should read HF is in House file number 473. So I'll make that change, and then move the amendment 473A1, and this puts it into the form that the author would like. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I apologize. I didn't look in your rules to see if I'm supposed to bring cookies with my first bill.
You're not.
As some committees request. But this bill comes from a constituent request where it was identified that we have in our bankruptcy law an inadequacy of something that's very important to a lot of people. And it simply adds wedding rings to the list of exemptions of what can be taken in a bankruptcy. That is to not exceed $1,225, and that's all the bill does. The amendment makes it clear that if that wedding ring is in a debtor's possession, that would not apply. So we're not interfering with pre-existing situations where a debtor is holding that in their possession for a debt, but only from this day forward. And that's all the bill does. The current law, as you know, there's federal bankruptcy law and state law. I'll just note that when a person files for bankruptcy, they have an option. They can choose the federal list or the state list of exemptions. And currently, the federal list includes a provision that involves jewelry or wedding rings, and what we're doing is simply adding to the state list to establish that similarity and balance or consistency.
Okay. Any questions for Representative Olson? Representative Deal Forrest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Olson, just curious, so I understand correctly then
first of all, that Minnesota did not allow for any type of exemption for wedding rings and other jewels?
Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Villaforce, that is correct.
Okay. And one follow-up, Mr. Chairman. Representative Olson, what is the exemption amount with respect to federal law?
Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Villaforce, that amount is $1,000 in value. Now, why the Senate, this bill has moved in the Senate, and I'm working with my senator on this. The exact logic for the 1225, I think, begging the senator's pardon, but I think it has to do with some sort of inflationary adjustment over time and just still basically similar from what was established in federal law.
Representative Westbrook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Olson, on another question after this one, but Representative DeLaForce asked where that number came to. Is it indexed? And my first reaction is someone who has recently bought one of these things. $1,225 doesn't buy much of a ring. I'm not saying I spent more than that, but I'm telling you, there's a lot of people that probably do. I'm not saying I spent less than that either. But.
Representative Weston, don't tell my wife that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Westrom, that is correct. I recently bought one myself, and I have no personal interest in this bill. Number one, I hope to never file, but number two, it would not apply to me either. This is the number that we've worked with, and all the parties that are involved have agreed to it, and it really covers more so those of lower income. And I understand that this would apply to most of the bankruptcies. The attorney that brought this to me concurred that this would apply to most of the bankruptcies that he has worked with. And I thought that that this is a reasonable request. And that's why I just agreed to carry the bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd be interested in what other people think on the value, but am I understanding this correctly? Now, if your ring has a $2,000 value, you file bankruptcy, who gets the privilege of coming out, taking the ring off, and saying, you got to buy a cheaper ring, we're going to sell this one? And is the value actually on what they're going to get at a pawn shop or trade-in, or is it the value of what it was when they purchased it, or I don't know, how do they establish a value? But am I right in the scenario that even if it was worth more than $1,225, that they'd turn the ring in and then have to buy a cheaper one, or none at all?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Westrom, I beg your pardon. I also need to note that I failed to answer fully your previous question. This is not indexed. That's one point I missed.
Okay.
In your previous question. Now to your current question, and one part of it I may need to refer to counsel because it was a question that I had, and we didn't connect before the meeting. We're all so busy, but I believe we need to look into the current law to answer your question. And I'm looking right now, and if counsel can help me with that, you may know it off the top of her head.
Ms. Knight?
Mr. Chair and Representative Olson, I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to Representative Westrom's specific question. That is whether what happens to the ring. I don't know the answer, and I can certainly find out. And you and I were in opposite meetings, and that's why we couldn't hook up before. So. I'm sorry, I just don't have the answer to that now.
Mr. Chair, I understand and apologize to Representative Westrom and the members that we weren't able to connect. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, and I don't know if there's somebody in the audience that would know the answer to that question of, you know, under current law, what you're saying is even if it's a $500 value, they take the ring and that's gone. My next question.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, I didn't understand your last point there.
Under current law, without this change, you're saying under current law, if the ring's worth $500, it ring's worth any value, they can take it in the bankruptcy, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, that is correct.
Okay.
And I was told by the constituent and attorney who requested this that he described being faced with people told they had to forfeit their rings. He didn't get to the detail of what happens if they're unwilling to do it and who's going to come out and take the ring off their hand. You know, I would suspect in normal situations, that being an abnormal one, but in situations like that, at some point something has to give and somebody has to be forced, they have to be forced to do it. The court would order it, and I would think somebody would have to be commissioned to take it if they're unwilling to forfeit it.
Sure.
But we're really not addressing that here, and I believe, counsel, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me, just knowing the process to the extent that I do, I would think that somebody would have to be commissioned to do that if they're unwilling to forfeit it. But we're not really addressing that here. That would be a court action.
Okay, and that's fine. I'm sure it would be the sheriff that would get to do it. But one other question I've gotten, this is my last one, Mr. Chair. What happens in a divorce situation? Is this only for currently married people, or what if I've got a wedding ring? Well, not me, because it's somebody's got a wedding ring from a prior marriage. I mean, is that part of the jewelry, or is that then exempted because it was a wedding ring?
Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrum, that's a very good question. I believe by the definition of by what's in this law currently, the debtor, whoever holds that ring, and the person who owes the money, if it happens to be, if the person who owes the money and is in the bankruptcy court happens to be the person who holds possession of that ring, that would be exempt up to $1,225. If they're the ones that actually hold possession of that ring. In other words, divorce would not change anything because it would really depend upon who owes the money and whether or not they hold possession of that ring. Hopefully that answers your question.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think what that says is, if I understood the answer and the interpretation, if someone was divorced, got remarried 5 years later after their second marriage, they file bankruptcy, but for some reason she's still got her wedding ring from the first marriage, that first wedding ring would still be exempted, and it seems to me that's not what we would want to exempt. We would want to exempt a current existing marriage with a ring, wouldn't we?
Mr. Chair, you have a very thorough committee here for the Representative Westrum. The if I understand you correctly, Representative Westrum, the if a person is divorced and remarried and they hold possession of two rings, I would hope they want to preserve and maintain possession of the current ring for the current marriage. And under this, I believe it could be argued, but it would have to be determined by the court. I believe it could be argued that if their current ring was only worth $500 and the other ring was worth $500, we're not addressing the issue. I believe it could be argued that both rings should be retained in possession. What the court would decide, I don't know. We're not addressing that issue because we're not dealing with divorce law here. We're just trying to create an exemption, a modest one, maybe even conservative one, for value of a wedding ring, so it's not taken.
Mr. Chair, I don't mean to belabor this at all, but
Mr. Chair,
what I'm wondering is maybe the amendment of inserting the word one in front of wedding ring would imply one wedding ring.
Mr. Chair, but Representative Westrum, we do have plural there, and I suspect that's because it could be a married couple and be protecting both rings. So the situation that Representative Westrum raised does create a complication. I mean, I'll just yield to the committee as to what you want to do. Your thoroughness is commendable, and I can see now that I should have brought cookies.
Representative Olson, Ms. McKnight has a thought on
Mr. Chair and members, we just had a couple of thoughts here. One of the things that many of you probably know is that bankruptcy can be an individual proceeding, but often it's filed by a couple. So if you had a married couple and they both had rings, then you'd have two rings. And my husband's and my rings cost $130 30 years ago. So then presumably even today they aren't worth more than $1,200, and we could exempt both of them. And I presume Representative Olson would want to do that. The other way that plural might apply is you might think for women who have a diamond engagement ring and a wedding band that that's two rings, and presumably if it was under $1,200, you'd want to protect both. So I think the plural is a good idea, or at least there's a good argument for it.
Representative De La Forest? Yeah, then that I can already see the court case, whether the woman's wedding ring, the band, is one or two. Representative Olson, I just had a very quick question. You know, it seems to me the public policy, am I right in saying we want wedding rings to remain in the possession of debtors, that we don't want them to lose a potential family heirloom. Am I right in assuming that?
Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair, Representative De La Forest, that is the thrust of the bill, at least up to a certain value.
Sure.
If there's a wedding ring of extremely high value, we're raising the issue with that because of the fact that in this particular case they would in fact owe lots of money to lots of people who may not be able to afford that kind of a ring themselves, and there's a certain equity issue that's brought to bear there.
Mr. Chair, my only thought is I have no quarrel with the bill. I have no amendment to offer, but as Representative Westrom mentioned, many, many, many of these rings exceed $1,225 in value, and I think that if we had a public policy to protect the rings, we're sort of perhaps leaving a lot of people outside that policy, but this is a fine bill. We probably talked about it too much.
Representative Simon. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Olson. Just in perusing through the statute book here, I think that my read anyway of 550.37 is that the value amounts, it says subdivision 21 says for the purpose of this section, the word value in quotes means current fair market value. That's the first point. And then the second point is the way that the statute now seems to deal with that issue of the value being way more than 1225 is that if it is way more than 1225, people aren't taking rings off fingers, but it sounds like the creditor would just have a security interest in the ring so that if it was ever sold, then they'd have to forfeit some of the profits. That's just my read, but I'm just looking at it pretty much for the first time here. So I'm sounds like a great proposal to me. I mean, if it were up to me, we should probably exempt the whole amount, but this seems to strike a reasonable balance. But I guess that answers the fair market value question, whether value is when you bought it or now.
All right. I don't see any further discussion.
I don't think
no. The chair will renew his motion that House File 473 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and next time I'll bring cookies.
Or wait till April.
Wait till April.
Yeah.
No, I appreciate your thoroughness, and Mr. Chair, if I may, if members feel that this number should be raised, please come and talk to me. It's one of the issues we struggled with. We're just trying to mirror the federal law.
Thank you.
Thank you.
House File 511 is next on the agenda, Representative Mahoney. And Chair, actually, I've been moving everything. Somebody else want to have some fun and move a bill?
Mr. Chair, I'll move bill number
511. Representative Ellison moves House File 511 be recommended to pass and sent to General Register.
At this particular time, we may have to talk. I may have to ask counsel when we're done with an amendment. But.
All right. And this is also your amendment, Representative Mahoney?
I'm looking at the A2 amendment.
Oh, the A2 amendment.
There was two amendments. There's an A1 and an A2. And I decided to do the A2 amendment.
We don't have the A2 amendment. The page will make copies of the A2 amendment, Representative Mahoney. Maybe in the meantime, if you want to tell us about your bill while he's doing that would be great.
Well, I can tell you about the bill. There's the page. This is at least my copy of it here. It's nice to come back to this committee. I used to sit on it, and for those that of our constituents that says there is no turnover, I think there's only two people from the last time I served in this 4 years ago that are still here, and they're both paid more than you and I. So So it's nice to be back. I always liked civil law. I found it a very, very interesting committee, and I was surprised at the things that you covered. But this bill, which is House File 511, is designed to do is to address some issues in the campaign finance laws and how they are able to be enforced. The bill came about, some constituents of mine came to me with an issue of an elected official who in the past had been accused of embezzling money from a political party. And so I put this bill together and I put it in thinking that I would make my constituent relatively happy and I would never hear from that person again. It's never been done before around here. All of a sudden I started hearing from county attorneys and local police officers and local political officers of local political parties. So I guess the bill has more value than sometimes we give our bills credit for. This bill came about because in this state, if a party officer embezzles money from a political party, or at least in this case, they generally won't get caught until their reports are filed with the Campaign Finance Board. And at that particular point, what has happened in these two cases is the person who has embezzled the money has made is caught. The party calls the police, reports the crime. The crime is reported. The police get involved. All of a sudden, the county attorneys are involved. The officer of the political party that has embezzled money goes back to the political party and says, "Geez, I promise you I'll pay it all back. Let's just drop this criminal complaint. Then we don't have to open up our books and all this other stuff, and nobody's embarrassed." And the political parties say, "Well, geez, we don't want to embarrass ourselves." And I agree that no one likes to embarrass yourself. And they go along with this. And then all of a sudden, from the conversations I've had with the local police officers and prosecutors, all communication and all cooperation stops from the political party and law enforcement between the two. Phone calls are not returned. Records are lost. Memories fade very quickly. So what this bill does, once the amendment is back, I will offer that amendment, which will give the prosecutors a tool to go to the political party officers, that the innocent victims, really, that have decided that they don't want to cooperate, they don't want to protect this money, a tool to say, "You need to come to the table and work with us so that we can put criminals in jail or fine them," or in many cases, we are all political animals, quite often most of us have served as an officer of a local political party, so you start on your career as an elected official, as a political party officer. Well, in this particular case, there is someone in the state that has pretty much embezzled, alleged to have embezzled money, made a private deal to pay it back, and all of a sudden that particular political party has said, "We don't want the embarrassment. We don't want to have anything." And so there's no cooperation between the prosecutors and this political party. And what the amendment, A2, when it gets here, really does is require allows the party officer, chair, treasurer, or anyone that would report to be charged with a misdemeanor and fined $1,000. And talking to county attorneys, they're not interested in charging an innocent victim. But they do need to be able to tell them that if you do not cooperate, if you do not help us prosecute these criminals that are stealing money, and I need to tell you where this money comes from, we do have the option of doing that. We have to remember, as servants of the public and stewards of the public money, most political parties' money comes from the $50 campaign refund. So when money is embezzled from a political party, it's really being embezzled from the taxpayer. And that money needs to be protected. And the A2 amendment, when it gets back here, will do that. It will give the prosecutors the opportunity to encourage a reluctant organization to cooperate with the prosecutors to the extent that we would all expect them to cooperate, trying to get a criminal either put in jail or put it on the record and get the money back and do what really we should be doing. The amendment is coming around. I'll tell a joke or do a dance here until it gets there. And
dance.
Dance.
Okay. Yeah. Representative Mahoney, you had mentioned something about a misdemeanor. That is in the A1 but not the A2 amendment. Because if there was,
yes,
if
I'm
misdemeanors
sorry.
In there, we'd have to send it to
yeah.
public safety, but we probably won't.
You're correct. I'm sorry.
So Representative Ellison will move the H0511A2 amendment to put the bill into the form that the author would like. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Questions? Or would you like to talk more? Questions?
No, I can stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mahoney, I guess I'm just trying to process the thoughts, and I, you know, I appreciate you bringing this forward. If the ultimate goal is to get, is it reporting or is it charging the report? Or is it charging the offense?
The ultimate goal is to get prosecution of the offense. The problem that seems to be, that's being brought forth, is that the charge is made, and then all of a sudden witnesses' memories get really dim, records get lost or misplaced, phone calls don't get returned. Mm-hmm. So prosecutors all of a sudden don't have the tools to bring the accused criminal to court. What this says is, if it's so blatant that, you know, 6 months ago you had all these records and now all, and a very reasonably clear memory, now all of a sudden that you've negotiated a private deal to get that $10,000 or $15,000 repaid, you all of a sudden have all these difficulties remembering or finding things or whatever, the prosecutors can say to them, you know, we understand what you're doing and we do have the option of making a charge against you and a civil fine of $1,000. And that's what this is trying to do, is to jog the memories and cooperation of a party officer.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mahoney, maybe you can help me with current practices then. The same political party would have to report to the Campaign Finance Board right now. So is it really an intent to speed up the knowledge of that something has occurred? I mean, or is it more of a case that when you report as a party, and I guess I haven't done that myself, but you report expenditures and receipts, does the embezzlement not show up?
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, that's generally when it's found out.
Okay.
But the campaign board can fine somebody, but there's no fine to be really doled out if money is stolen from your party or from your organization in a political sense. They can really only fine people if we do a violation of campaign laws. It's not a violation of the campaign laws to embezzle that money. It's a violation of criminal law to embezzle money from you, I, political party, a corporation or anyone. So the Campaign Finance Board really doesn't have any ability to fine or prosecute the embezzler.
Okay.
So what this is trying to get back to is to allow the county attorneys to do that.
I guess I'll just do one follow-up and then maybe I'll have a couple of questions more later. But Representative Mahoney, I guess one of my concerns is that when you talk about innocent victims, we're then going to turn around and punish these folks. With not only a fine, but essentially putting things on the books in a criminal manner. Maybe I'm misunderstanding what you're saying, and that's a good thing.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Well, let me try to explain a little bit different. Most people, if a crime is committed against us, or a member of the committee or a member of the public, we try to cooperate with the police and bring the criminal to justice and go through the witness, you know, become a witness at a trial if that's the need, and give testimony. What has happened in the past, and seems to be happening in the last two high-profile ones, is that the crime is reported. It's reported by the appropriate party chair or party treasurer. The investigation starts. The police department writes a report and some other things. And then all of a sudden, the person who has embezzled the money, you know, that whomever it would be, goes up to the party chair or whomever is in control of the finances and says, you know, yeah, I did wrong, I'm sorry. But you know what, I don't really want to go through a criminal prosecution and I don't want you to get embarrassed. Would it be okay if I just paid you back the money and we drop all this? You know, if it was $100, you know, it might be fine and save the taxpayers' money and lawyer fees. But quite regularly, county attorneys are not taking these on unless they're talking in the thousands of dollars. So what this bill does is when that party chair, and I'll just use the name party chair, has made that deal with the embezzler to get the money back. It's a private deal, non-legal, non-binding. All of a sudden, they decide that they don't want to pursue the criminal charges. So what my bill does, and yes, it can make an innocent victim into a civil fine, but only if that innocent victim decides that they don't want to participate in a criminal prosecution of someone stealing tax, political money or money coming out of a $50 refund. So all I'm trying to do, and in my conversations with some of the prosecutors, is we're not going to charge somebody with this unless they for some reason start to say, you know, under no circumstances will I testify, I'm going to fight you all the way. We need to actually, if somebody's stealing tax, I feel this is taxpayer dollars. If somebody's stealing that, we should prosecute them.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mahoney, a political committee, since this is the way you have it drafted for purposes of the campaign finance laws, is, in my understanding, a corporate entity. And as a corporate entity, it has a board of members that are typically assembled in accordance with requirements set forth in bylaws, like a corporate entity should. That board of elected members then makes decisions on how to operate the organization, including decisions, I suspect, relating to the area that you're talking about, which has to do with how they handle their funds, disbursements, how they handle their internal complaints or maybe errors, and how they decide to operate that business is within the board's function. Your bill, your proposed bill, would propose to take that authority away from the board and give it to the state. I think I understand the argument is that, at least the way you're presenting it, is it's 50, the money for these organizations is all $50 and $100 contributions, and that's taxpayer money under the public subsidy program. The problem I have is, and I have two questions. The first one is, the bill you're proposing, I don't think that argument flies, by the way, personally, because we do have disclosure requirements under the campaign finance laws, and they must disclose. The concern I have is the way the bill's drafted, don't you open up the potential for a lot of, and I'm new around here, so if I choose the wrong words, I apologize ahead of time, but don't you create an area that's ripe for political cheap shots, where people make allegations, turn it over to the state, and we just create all kinds of, time for lawyers.
Representative Mahoney?
This bill is, there's a number of questions in there. This bill is drafted with the intent and to the purpose of requiring the chair, associate chair, or whoever would be in charge of that political unit to be the one that the prosecutor would go and say, you need to cooperate? That was the first question. So it's kind of, yes, I am taking the board out of it, but if someone has stolen money from 3M, it's not the decision of the board to prosecute or not prosecute if they've stolen $1,000 or $10,000. It's a criminal action, and it should be prosecuted, and that person should be punished so that they don't go on to bigger and better things. And the other question, I'm sorry.
Political cheap shots.
Political cheap shots. I don't know how. I mean, if somebody steals money, the police are not going to get involved at all unless someone files a criminal complaint. Because that's how that generally works. They have to file a criminal complaint before the prosecutors come into play here. And there generally needs to be some evidence. The police aren't going to move forward without some financial records that say, this is what happened and that's where it went, and at least get a view of them.
Right. Mr. Chair, can I follow up? And that's the whole point, is that right now that's the system we have. If somebody wants to file a criminal complaint and follow through on it, they have that right. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that your bill would propose to give that right to the state to decide if they want to create that criminal complaint, pursue it, rather than have the board, and I'll use your 3M example, make an internal determination as to whether or not the the error, the mistake, or the action is constitutes theft or conversion. That's essentially what you're taking away from the board as I read your proposed bill. The bigger question, and this is the follow-up, is I don't understand if this is truly necessary, why wouldn't we have this type of legislation address these 527 organizations where we truly have an issue of people circumventing organizations clearly in a position to circumvent our campaign finance laws? Why wouldn't you have a similar requirement for these 527 organizations?
Because I've never really delved into what the 527s are doing or how they've done it, and I would certainly be willing to take a look at a bill like that if you chose to try to enter one. I'm not sure whether it would be on a federal or a state level, to be honest.
Okay.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mahoney. Most of these boards are volunteers. And so then the question begs, is it the board that is responsible, or is it the BPOU chairman or chairwoman or vice chair? Where is the line drawn? And I don't think as volunteers they have the same fiduciary responsibility as, say, the mayor of a city. And who's going to be paying this $1,000 fine? Are we going to then be taking it from those same $50 contributions? I don't disagree with what you're trying to get at. I just don't see that what we've got here is something that we can do. I'm having real trouble getting my arms around a way to make it work. And if you could comment on my comments, there really wasn't a question there. But how would we make that work?
Mr. Chair, again, and I went over it fairly quickly in my explanation of the bill. Prosecutors are not looking to come after, if I was a party chair, they don't want to fine me. What they want me to do as a party chair is to clear the cobwebs out of my brain cells and actually talk to them about what happened, how I found it out, follow through on the complaint, whether it's criminal or civil, and move forward. To open up the books, to do all the things that would allow them to follow through on a criminal complaint, a police report, a criminal complaint, and a prosecution of someone who's stealing these dollars from these political organizations. In the rare case, could someone be fined $1,000? I suppose. Up until just a few years ago, and that's one of the reasons I did not go with the misdemeanor or the felony charges, we used to have felony and misdemeanor charges in all of our campaign laws. And I have to be honest, I don't in my memory, remember anyone going to jail or getting charged with a felony, there was some, I think there might have been a misdemeanor. We had some pretty horrific laws. You're not charged. So that's why I kept it as a civil fine. Is it paid by the chair? I would expect not. I would expect it to be paid by the political party unit. My other thought was to kind of like not make them eligible, but somebody told me that would be a little hard to get past. Eligible for the $50 rebate. I mean, does that answer what your concerns were?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, a great deal, but I still have a tough time with the total concept. By taking it out of the misdemeanor, et cetera, helps a great deal, but it still doesn't answer exactly who would pay. And the up to is, that's pretty really discretionary. But I understand where you're coming with it. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, I apologize for being late. I was in another committee doing a bill, and I think the concern about theft is legitimate. If you look at I'm completely concerned about online banking. I mean, I don't know if any of you use it, but you know, people can transfer funds like that, and you know, a whole bunch of money just disappears in a matter of seconds or goes somewhere else. And but why? What did this come from a specific case, or why are you doing this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Sollert. In Ramsey County, there was an election held this last November, and a candidate had been accused of embezzling, and the number I've been using, $10,000 from the political party that they were a member of. And the prosecution was moving forward, the police were doing the interviews, they were doing all the things you would normally see in Law and Order or something. And lo and behold, it was one of a low-level, I hope not to insult anybody there, but an under-the-radar elected office, this person won. And, geez, I don't understand why, but all of a sudden, that party forgot that they had appointments with police officers. They forgot what day it was that they had made their calls to the police department. They couldn't find their records. There's just all sorts of things, and not returning phone calls. So having called the local police officers that I talked to said it became next to impossible to get any help out of any of those officers of that political party. It's one of the minor parties. I don't want to get besmirch some political party. You know, it would be so out of character for me. Does that kind of give you an answer?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. That gives us some context, and of course, I live in Ramsey County, so that's interesting. But is that how common? Is this common, and did they ask? Did someone approach you about doing this bill, or did you just come up with it all by yourself?
We rarely come up with ideas on our own. You know, we always, all of our constituents have so many better ideas than we do. A couple members of the constituents from Ramsey County brought this forth to me. This has happened twice in recent memory and very fresh memory, and I'm told it's happened a couple other times a few years back. So it's 3, 4, 5 times in the last decade. And the police and the county attorneys just say that we can't get any cooperation. And so we hardly even try to go through the form until as soon as they stop cooperating, we just stop working on it.
Person left.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, and I apologize for being late. Also, I was off doing something really important. My question relates to, and apologies if you've already answered this, but obviously political party units are fluid things, and they're officers in those positions. It's truly thankless work. Only those people that are truly committed to putting in a lot of hours to submitting reports and reporting to the board as required, which sometimes can be rather arcane and Byzantine, are the ones who end up sticking in the job. Once in a while, those are political people who are called off to do different jobs during a political season, and positions go vacant, and no one knows who's holding the ball, and it ends up on individuals outside of the officer positions to come through and take care of that. In those situations, sometimes it's hard to figure who's to blame for this. Does this bill take that into account, that certain follow-up and actual culpability is solid before the $1,000 is imposed?
Senator Mahoney?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lesh, my intent is to have the party held responsible for the finances of it. And if the chair is not being responsive, the party chair is not being responsive, the intent of this bill is to not have that particular party chair or the party unit chair have to pull out his or her personal checkbook and write a $1,000 check. And if the committee has wording that would make that clearer, I'm more than comfortable with that. But and also to address maybe what you were talking about, you could put and past political chairs, but I don't think it needs it once you get past the party unit. Because once you've told the party that they're going to find them, they're going to try to track down whoever it is. I mean, $1,000 is a lot of money to a Senate district or to a local party unit. And it's a substantial fine, and then the embarrassment of a civil fine in the newspaper for a state party is even more so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mahoney, the problem that I have with the bill is, in its current form, is that this deals only with reporting. It wouldn't deal with what you have given us an example of what the problem is. I mean, it doesn't deal with the question of whether anyone is going to cooperate with the prosecution or not, and I don't see how it could. But it seems like you want to go beyond where this started out, which was to just say that it's necessary to report this when you become aware of it rather than let it show up in an annual report.
You actually have found a flaw in the bill, and you're right. On the A2 amendment, I think if on line 4, let me read it here just for a second. You would delete the word as and put in and law enforcement as required by this. You wouldn't have to delete the as, but after the board put in and law enforcement as required by this subdivision is subject to a penalty. Certainly could just fix it that way.
Representative Hilty, would that address your concern?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, the problem is that it still is only talking about reporting.
Correct.
And the example that you cited, and what is presumably the reason that you think this should be advanced, you're not talking about the failure to report, you're talking about failure to cooperate.
Correct.
And I don't see how this bill would be an incentive to cooperate. I mean, people have the right in any prosecution, I presume, at some point to just decide not to cooperate.
Mr. Chair.
And the fine that you're talking about and the requirement that we're talking about is simply to report this when you become aware of it. So I could report something I became aware of, and then if a prosecution went forth, decide, well, I really don't think that this ought to be going forward, and I'm just not going to cooperate anymore. I wouldn't get fined $1,000 for that.
I'm sorry, what?
I wouldn't get fined $1,000 for failing to cooperate. I would get fined only if I didn't report it in the first place.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hilty, having spoken with the county attorneys that have responded, they said this would be more than enough to allow them to put pressure on to get cooperation in trials. The county attorneys have said that they think this would work.
Representative West?
I just want to address briefly. Oftentimes, when you're charging a case or as prosecutor, you need to decide what charges can be brought forth and what charges are provable. The critical thing is for law enforcement to have the resources in the first place to follow up on a report of a breach of the law. And oftentimes, if it's being reported by an individual, law enforcement has that individual on the hook. And it allows law enforcement to go back to that individual who is responsible for the original complaint to follow up on the complaint and potentially get other names and evidence that they can use to build a case. So I guess the way I look at it, and I understand Representative Hilty's concern, but when I look at it this way, forcing the hand initially by requiring to report gives law enforcement a foothold that they would otherwise not have. And obviously, if folks leapfrog over that and after the fact decide that they're not going to cooperate after they reported it, that's an additional concern. But I think the language goes toward making that less likely to happen than it does more likely. So that's why I think it's okay.
Representative Mahoney, I'm thinking based upon the discussion, and I may lay this on the table. I don't know if you had any thoughts to this, but that might make some sense to talk to some of these issues outside. And
actually, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to ask that you lay this bill over and lay it on the table and let me talk to some of the members and see if some of the county attorneys want to come in and talk to people and alleviate some of the fears. But
okay.
We'll see what we can do.
That's great. We will lay this on the table. Any other business? Seeing none, we're adjourned.